Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidivishravahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Tattva Sandarbha, Adhyayana 3, Adhikarna 2, Understanding the Jiva and the Supreme Brahman, from Anucheda 54, page 59. Prana follows the jiva in bodies born from eggs, andeshu, worms, peshishu, seeds, tarushu, and perspiration, anvini, chiteshu. In this example, the unchanging nature of the Atma is shown in various bodies. Then the unchanging nature of one body is shown. The Atma seems to change when, yet, the senses are active in the waking state. When in a dreaming condition, the ahankara remains active, holding impressions of the senses. When in deep sleep, with the senses and ahankara, ahami, merge, sanne, in the atma, the atma remains unchanged, kutastha. Why? It is devoid of upadis of the subtle body, ashrayamrite, the cause of change. The upadis, I guess, being absent, have been dissolved. So the prana moves within the living entities, and whatever body they're in, right? So these four here, born from eggs, womb, seed, and perspiration, that's how all living entities come into existence within the material world. Right? So they have the life force there, and that's then always with them. So we see is whatever is the situation, the soul travels through all these, the soul remains the same, right? The bodies are changing. Then they're showing the aspect when they're looking at the perspective of the jiva, or the consciousness of the jiva. So then that's changing, right? Because then they're awake, then they're perceiving one thing. When they're asleep, then the impressions are still there, but the active elements are not. So then you end up with the dreams, and then deep sleep, then when all this gets merged back into the jiva, and then it's the one again, right? You see where these guys are going with this, right? Means when you have the deep sleep, then there's nothingness, right? You know, so then trying to say, because you always mention it changes shape, and it'll only change in the first two, being awake or being in dream, but not in deep sleep, right? So that's then always those who are trying to find a solution to the material world. Either you're trying to find a solution to the problems by creating good facility, or by getting rid of everything, right? So these seem to be the two options, right? Nothing in between, really, right? I mean, you can try to get facility while you're trying to get rid of everything, right? Okay, then who's this now again? This is Purva Paksha? Okay. When ahankara and senses stop functioning, what remains is a state of void, right? See, this is where they're going with it. How is the unchanging Atma present at that time? The memory or witness, smriti, of deep sleep of the indivisible Atma, tat, arises for us, tat, the seers in the waking state. We think, wait a minute. That was the end of theirs. Yeah, okay. So theirs is just, how is the unchanging Atma present at that time? So they're saying is that when they stop functioning in the ahankara, then when you're in deep sleep, then that's void. So their point is, so where's the Atma? Right? Because they don't understand consciousness is the Atma. They're taking as consciousness is just another material thing. They don't understand consciousness comes beyond the material. The material nature is not conscious. That's pretty straightforward. Right? So, the memory or witness, smriti, of deep sleep of the individual atma, tat, arises for us, the seers, in the wake state, waking state. We think, quote, for that time I slept and was not aware of anything, end quote. There is this awareness of atma deep sleep because of not remembering any particular experience. It is not clear awareness since there's a lack of relationship with objects. Like the manifestation of self-revealing objects like the sun, this awareness of the atma, being simply awareness of the self, takes shelter of itself. Right? So the atma is still there because you say deep sleep, but the atma can say, I slept with, you know, I was in deep sleep. So many sense. So they're aware enough of that because the living entity is consciousness. So yes.
What are they trying to prove?
They're trying to prove that all this, you know, like the Mayavadis, because the Mayavadis are their philosophy, that all the forms and shapes and interactions and feelings and all that's all illusion. So then the natural state is just nothingness. Right? But the point is if you're an individual and you're suffering, but if it's all an illusion, what does it matter? It's not real. You know? So that's the problem is they have an idea that this will be very, very nice. But at the same time, it's not. You know, it's just like, let's say, you're suffering in a particular way. So any other situations or, you know, examples where they're not suffering in that way, you'll always take that's the ideal. Even though that person may be suffering in other ways, you just ignore that. You just see the part you want to see. So in all these philosophies, they don't make sense because even though they claim it's all intellectual and all that kind of stuff, it's all based on their own subjective desire, their own subjective impressions. You can't get away from that. The idea that you're going to have this intellectual platform that doesn't have any of this, it's just purely objective, like is discussed, you know, I mean, scholars tend to think like that. That's my view is purely subjective. Like, I don't know, you noticed yesterday in the class?
Yes.
Yeah, is that two persons asked the question. One was just a general question and all that, but then right in the back somebody asked and then they had their perspective. And then you answer the question and then point out how there's a perspective behind that. And then for them it was kind of like interesting because they're not necessarily noticing that. And so that, you know, they had their understanding or their doubt, and then the doubt is cleared, and then you point out how that doubt is based on a particular perspective that they have, a particular impression or samskara, you know, or something they're trying to achieve. So the 'cause you're asking the doubt supposedly from an objective point of view, but it's based on some subjectivity, right? So for the first person, it worked well, and they were quite, you know, happy with that. You know, it's always interesting to, you're seeing it one way, and then there's more you could see. It just opens up, you know, the vista of how you can perceive things. But the second person, then you explain it, they don't understand it, because they want a particular answer. Right? Because they think, is how I see things, that's the real, and how anybody else sees is not real. And then when you point out the background of what is the motive or the intent on their question, then they just take it personally that, you know, why are you criticizing me? Rather than, no, it's the thought process, you know. Does that make sense? So they're identifying so strongly with the mind that they even though in their mind they identify themselves as intelligent, which they may have good intelligence, but it's so strongly identifying with the mind that if it doesn't give the experience that they want, then it's not real. Does that make sense? So therefore, their experience is all there is, right? Now, this is the fun. This is someone who identifies themselves as intellectual.
Right? There are many like this.
Yes. No, there are.
Standard. behavioral patterns.
Yes, it is. It is. And then they always fall back on the thing of why you're criticizing them, and they make it about themselves. When they can't, when they're wrong in the argument, then they make it about themselves. So that's also, you know, quite, you know, up to date. You know,
modern.
Yes, it's modern. Yes, it's, you know, keeping with the trends, right? You know, not the. Yeah. So that's the difficulty. Is here is that they have a particular thing they want, a particular experience they want. The idea of nothingness for them is nice because everything they deal with gives trouble. So nothingness would be good. So even though logically it doesn't make sense, they're still going to go with it. It means you can point it out and defeat their argument. Whether they accept it or not is a matter of whether they're sincerely want to know. Right? Like that. That's the difference. But otherwise, then it's giving a different experience. So as long as they can appreciate that different experience, and then they take it as some, because they're looking, then they'll get somewhere. But if it's they want a particular experience and how you express everything, then it doesn't matter what you do. Like someone asked, I mean, another kind of example of this, someone asked a question, and it was a very straightforward answer. But the person wanted, you know, all kinds of stories. In fact, you know, better, the more the better. Various stories from Mahabharata or the Puranas or somewhere, you know, elaborately told so that they could experience, you know, in that long way the answer. Rather than just they ask the question and present it intellectually. That's the fun part, is they always present it intellectually. So you give them that answer. And then they're not satisfied. No, it's not correct. And what's not correct? It's not that the logic isn't correct. It's that the experiential, the experience that they get from it is not what they're looking for. So in that way, because the experience is what we call concrete or what's real, then they'll just say it's an abstract answer. It doesn't have any real meaning because it didn't give them the experience they were looking for. Understand? So that's the whole thing, is that when we're dealing with the living entities, they're looking for that particular experience. So that's why by the chanting process associated with devotees and service, the heart becomes purified. Then you can appreciate higher levels of experience. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if someone's at a particular level of consciousness, they only experience things at that level. They can't experience above that. By association, you associate with someone who's above that, then you start to notice that it's there. And then you appreciate it. Right? It may not be steady for you, but at least you appreciate it. You go direction that's something you appreciate. Right? Let's say you see someone who behaves nicely. So then you appreciate that. So then you'll start to see opportunities where you could behave nicely. Right? It may take years and years, but you move forward. The opportunity is there. You didn't take it properly, then you'll contemplate it how you could have. Then it'll keep going like that for a while till then occasionally you get it right, or right for, you know, the first, someone says something, the first thing you say is correct, then after that, then you say something stupid. Right? Something sense. Yeah, so, and then eventually it starts becoming more and more. So that's what sadhana is. Sadhana means right now it's not the way you want it to be, but it slowly is moving in the direction of what you want it to be. But you have to be aware of it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like that. But the devotional process is so powerful, it will move us forward in consciousness even if we're not really so much aware of that. But at some point, we have to be aware. Because it's about pleasing Krishna. We have to make that commitment. We have to surrender. Right? So even if one's on a very pure state, you still have to surrender from that state. Does that make sense? Right? So the pure state, then there's nothing, not much attachment, there's a sense of duty, and you work by authority and all that. So then to surrender, one sense, there's no baggage. You could surrender very easily. Right? Does that make sense? Well, but at the same time, as you have the point, is if you're conditioned to that mode of goodness and you don't really see any problems, you don't see the need to surrender, even though it would be easier to surrender. Right? While if one's not so purified, right? So well situated. Then the difficulty comes is because of the cloud of ignorance and passion. One doesn't see actually the importance to surrender. Right? It's not that you're attached to being in that environment because there's the idea that you will enjoy, but you don't really. Or, from the other side, if you're tired of that, then it makes it very easy to surrender because you just see it's just crazy anyway. There has to be something else to do. Does that make sense? So that's every situation has its advantage and disadvantage. So by association, then we're able to take advantage and actually move forward. Yeah? Yes?
Can we say, Mars, then, in association, in the beginning we just reflect qualities of the person we associate with.
Yes.
And then slowly, slowly we develop our own.
Yes. Yes. It says, just like it says, it was saying before in the Nectar Devotion, that the reflection, it's not just while you're there. Even after you leave that association, that reflection will continue for some time. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you'll be able to experience, like you had, we're in the kirtan, it was really nice, you walk away from the kirtan, you're home. You can still remember, you can still kind of get that feeling and you may still have that interest. But after a time, you get distracted by, you know, whatever you do in the day and that, and don't think about it. And then when it comes up again, then again, it was a good experience and you're enthusiastic. And so it just becomes slowly, gradually. That's why sadhana is there. It's a gradual process. Gradual can be very quick. You know, gradual can be a moment. But otherwise, it can take, you know, a lifetime. So, you know. So, yeah, it's just upon us on how much we take advantage of the situation. So many sense. Because the choice, we always have the choice to do. But we generally choose, you know, not to. That's why we're here. Like that. We're very practiced. You know, our sadhana in not choosing the right choice is very, very well established. You know, we're nishta. You know, we have taste. We have attachment. You know. You know. I say, we have bhava and then the ultimate pure unalloyed lust. Right, you know. Yeah, so it's the same. So we're just reversing that. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Yeah, so the more we keep, then the more we see, then it starts to become our qualities as we take on by association. But we always still use the... Now, from that, that's important that, yes, that's what's happening, but there's also an importance within the consciousness that's there. Of our position, that humble attitude, right? So now, what is the example of the purified soul? What's the condition for that? Right? Means we're in the material world, and then we associate with the spiritual. That's the position, but I'm saying, what example? When we give an example, you know, an example would be something that is physically that you can see with the senses. No? Iron and fire? Okay? Yeah. Yes, I think sometimes it's that one.
Where are you going with that?
Yeah. So iron and fire. So what iron and fire is it, iron and fire then becomes as good as fire. Right? But can we become proud? Because we're not fire. You understand? So even if we have developed those qualities, we will understand that these qualities have come from those who we've associated with. So that's where the fire is. They have, and we're just taking on because of the association. So if you're always in that association, either directly or indirectly through remembering and practicing the instructions, then we're in that fire. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
If we follow to sadhana bhakti sometimes, and then we stop this process, then we can see that same desires and attachments return to our consciousness.
Yeah.
Does it mean that we didn't do any, that we didn't advance in Krishna consciousness? Or
no, it means we advanced and now we're not taking advantage of that advancement. It's just like, let's say you're standing inside. Right? It's nice and cool and pleasant inside. and outside is hot. Right? So as long as we stay inside, we're cool. But when we go outside, then the temperature becomes uncomfortable. Does that make sense? Yeah. I adjusted it, the example at the end, right? Because otherwise, then guys like to be cool, girls like to be hot. So, you know, yeah. So, yeah. So I had to keep it within temperature. Does that make sense? Yes? So the whole point is that's the point of iron and fire. If you're in the fire, then that's the quality you have. But if you come out, then it'll just manifest whatever's there before. That's the meaning of Punar Musika Bhava. It means that if someone, just like, let's say, within the movement, the person has come to quite an elevated position, you know, authority, can do so many things in Krishna consciousness. Then they think, okay, well, these devotees are bothering me, or this or that, no one appreciates me, you know, my greatness, my fabulousness, and, excuse me, your fabulousness, what's your opinion on, yeah, so, like that. So, then they think, I'll go out into the material world and the karmis, they'll appreciate it. But as soon as you step out, you don't have those qualities anymore because those are you know, from the iron and fire. They're reflecting from the others. And so you go back to wherever you were before you joined Krishna consciousness. Right? Does that make sense? So the phrase, you can't take it with you, goes both ways. You can't use all the nice qualities and skills and knowledge that you have from the spiritual into the material if you give up the spiritual. And you can't take the material with you to the spiritual realm. You know that little, what do you call it? You know, unicorn doll that you really like. You can't take it with you. Yeah. You have to leave it there. Yeah. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point. So, but you'll see the difference is that person, let's say they were at 50%, you know, and they step out and then they just go back to what they were like before. But now if they go back into Krishna consciousness, you'll see basically very, very quickly they'll come back to that 50%. Even though to get there may have taken them 10, 20 years. So they're not in the same position as a new bhakta. Because as soon as they come back, immediately they can do. Is that something else? Yeah. Okay. Okay. It is not clear. Okay, we said that. Like the manifestations of.
The Sanskrit.
Okay, the Sanskrit. Yad vai tanna pashyati pashyan vai. Drashtavyan na pashyati, nahi drashtur drishtor vipar rilopo vidyate. He certainly does not see, although seeing, he does not see what is to be seen. The seeing capacity of the seer is lost. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.3.23. The third inference for Atma is the difference between the witness and what is witnessed, seen in the above example. The fourth inference for Atma can be understood to be the difference between the sufferer, because of attachment to the body, and the shelter of prema, experienced apart from the body. Right? Because the body is there, and you're suffering because of our attachment. But then when one is absorbed in the transcendental platform, that is coming despite the body. Right? Yeah. Footnote 21. Prema is represented by I slept happily. Right? So you have the two things. There's one, you're there, you're experienced, and then the other is that it's there. Right? That's the what we're talking about, the aparoksha platform. So that aparoksha aspect, when we're dealing here as a general thing, then that experience that you have from the level of consciousness, that's one thing. And then the actual, what you're perceiving, is another.
No. So basically, we are trying to prove the simple thing that body and soul are different.
Yes, and the soul exists. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, then, for the Buddhist, there's no body, there's no soul. Yeah. So, and for the impersonalist, there's no body, there's the soul. Right? But but they don't know beyond that what the soul is, what is the actual definition. So they have some knowledge. That's why they're on the platform, that vijnana. They're able to give up attachment to the material world, but they're not actually on the platform to actually know who they are. So,
so we can say they're in between?
Who?
The Buddhists?
No, the Buddhists are at one end.
No, I mean...
The Mayavadis. Yeah, they're in between. So it's basically, there are Buddhists in the Vedic context. So because of the Vedic context, they have some actual knowledge that is beyond. The Buddhists may have some knowledge of the functioning of the world a bit, some of the metaphysical, but they don't understand the soul and its connection with the metaphysical. In that. Is that what I'm saying?
So we can say that modern people, they tend to be more close to the Buddhists because they don't
yes.
follow the Vedas.
Yeah,
and
that's you see, it's very, very rarely you ever see somebody take up, you know, kind of the Hindu scene and be an impersonalist from the West. Some do. But you'll see is in a general kind of public that if they're a little smart and a little bit aware how the material world's a problem, they'll easily accept Buddhism. Right? If there's nothing, don't worry about it, just meditate. And like that. And they'll add a little meditation into their life, you know, and it'll help them to some degree. Like that, so they'll be convinced of that. But they won't take it, you know, they won't be, generally will not be monks. Right? Okay. Yes.
All right. I'm not clear on aparoksha level because it's an emerging point.
Yes, because we're using it in two capacities. The one capacity we're using it in the context of it's one level in the five levels of consciousness in which how we are perceiving, how we're gaining knowledge.
Yes.
Yes. But it seems that the acharyas are using it in a different context where they're just simply showing that. That whatever your level of consciousness, you're perceiving things yourself, you're hearing from others, and then you're able to appreciate that level that's beyond the senses and all that.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
So then you can have these three on the five levels of consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it means that it has its place, but then within that you can also then establish. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like adiatmak, adidaivak, adibhautik.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it's also one of those ones where you're used to it applied in one way, but it also applies in everything. You know, the adiatmak will be, how you say, ourselves, the soul, the adidaivak will be the supreme lord, and the adibhautik will be the body, or, you know, in the senses that we're connected with.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? And then you can bring it down. The Adidaiva can be the demigods, and then you know, like this, and so it can be applied in many, many levels. So it's like a formula. So it appears that they're using it like a formula, because they're bringing in this experience apart from the body and showing about I slept happily. So that's the aparoksha, because they're using it to show that you're experiencing something even though it's not done through the senses. So by consciousness, you're aware of it. You know, but as you said, you're not necessarily as aware as in the waking state. Right? There is this awareness of Atma in deep sleep because of not remembering any particular experience. So you're aware that you're unaware. Right? There's no particular experience, there's no objects. That's the point. Dream has all these funny objects and they're doing weird things. You know, that are just not standard. You know, so, yeah.
The difficulty seems to be is that it belongs to both ascending and descending processes.
It's the top on the one, it's the bottom on the other.
Right, but how does it function in both?
Well, it's like it's like a Sunday, right? The twilight. You know, the twilight has elements of the day and elements of the night.
Right.
Does that make sense? But you also can make a distinction between the twilights. You know, the morning twilight and the evening twilight.
Yeah.
So the morning, it's dark going towards day, and the other is day going towards night.
Yeah.
Like that. So even there, so you have day, you have night, so you have to have the Sunday. But then even in the Sunday, you have to have that part this way and part that way. Like in astrology, you have a house. The house is 30 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But the influence of of the house after it is the end 30 degrees. Right?
Yeah.
And the influence of the house before it is the beginning 30 degrees.
Right.
So that means the Sunday is 30 degrees in one house, 30 degrees in the other house. So that's 60 degrees. But that 60 degrees, when it's in the one house, it'll have more of the flavor of the one and a touch of the other. The closer it gets, the more it has. Then it goes the other side. It's predominantly the other, but it still has a little left on the other side. So it's only right in the middle that you can say, now it's this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're always going to have that aspect. You know, that's the point. We have internal energy, we have external, then you have the marginal. And the marginal can lean towards the internal or towards the external. Right? So there's certain formulas that they can always be used. It's just that when they have a need, like here, they're using it to establish the consciousness. Right?
Yeah.
Like that. And so they're using it there. But otherwise, in general, you know, we'll use it. We can use it in connection with those five levels of consciousness, how we're gaining things. Like we're trying to show about the metaphysical and the universal form and the creation and that, then we're going to use the five levels of consciousness. Right? But in here, just because we're just using consciousness and whether the soul exists and their existence is consciousness, that's the whole point. That's how you tell they're there. Then at all three levels, because they're saying they're conscious here and that's illusion, and at this third state, they're not conscious. But we're pointing out, no, they still are conscious. Because they are conscious. Yes. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
So can we say, if we compare, can we say that aparoksha matching vijnana maya?
Means you have that element that they're there. It means the impersonalist, you know, yes. But for the Buddhist, you'll take it on that because they're functioning there, but they don't actually have the Vedic knowledge. So it'll be a distraction from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But you also have in that Vijnana Maya, you also have sadhakas.
Yeah.
You know? That they're situated there and they understand they're not the body, they have that realization, therefore they're functioning as servants of Krishna. And so that's their situation, but they're moving within the realm of Anandamaya.
Right.
You know, but it has to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And those who are the impersonalists, if they have some realization, it's just as beginning stages of Anandamaya. Like that. They don't actually, they're just experiencing the eternality of it. And just that much knowledge that they have that eternality. But otherwise, they don't really know who they are. And what the actual, you know, spiritual process and this. So it just becomes, it's just an intellectual position. You know, just an awareness. So you'll have always these Sundays and everything. So you have the clear thing is like Anamoy, you know, is the conscious of the sensual. But then within that you have the unsophisticated and the sophisticated. Right? So you can have the, you know, the how do you say the, what do you call it? Finding the first proper word. A individual of a First Nation, how you say, social structure. Does that make sense? No. To use an archaic term, an aboriginal or a tribal. Because in the Vedic, they call everybody in tribes. You're in a group because it has a group. So Kshatriyas are a tribe. Brahmins are a tribe. Like that. In the Vedic sense. But in the modern, then it becomes, you know, something else. They can only apply it down because they don't see that they're a tribe like that. Some intellectuals that sit on the side and make comments like that, but, you know, the general public don't necessarily appreciate it. Yeah. So then you'll have the sophisticated person. He may, you know, his sophistication may be in the form of dressing nicely, eating nicely. He has his particular mannerisms that, you know, he gets everything done that he wants to get done, or you know, he's into mechanics or electronics or science or that. So he's very sophisticated. But it's only based on what benefit he gets from it. That's why he's doing it. Right? So you have those, and they don't necessarily socially function. They're known as self-centered people. Right? Then you move forward into the pranamoy, where then it's based on what's good for everybody. Right? And so you'll have more individual at the lower end and more collective at the other end. If you go too individual, the system falls apart because then no one cooperates. If you go too collective, you lose the individual, so why would you even bother? Right? Because you're an individual and you want to take part in the collective because then you get more benefit. But if it's just purely collective where there is no individual benefit or identity, then what's your position? Why would you do that? Then you become, you're the same as a chair or something. Right? So that makes sense. So you'll always have this range there. And in that, then, to maintain it, you have to have, that's what you're defining as ethics. Ethics and morality. What are the ethics and morality for the collective group? And if it gets, somebody takes advantage, okay, what's the individuality? And then when they take advantage, no, what's the collective? So you see, they're always trying to balance between someone exploiting the system. Because there's no standard, the rules are not standard according to the metaphysics of the universe. Those ones that are, they'll do nicely, but those ones that aren't will always be a problem. And because it's by the modes of nature, it's not based on authority of scripture and that, then it can be distracted. You might have a tradition and it works, people do it, and things go nicely, but if someone brings up a doubt and they make a noise about it, because general people won't bring it up. Those who are intellectual bring it up. And so when they bring it up, then they bring it out and try to argue it and this and that. And then slowly, slowly over time, the general public, it starts to become part of their scene. So the tradition is lost. So the whole culture just changes. Does that make sense? It's just like you have Italians from Rome that lived there, born, brought up there, but you technically don't have any Romans, like Caesar. You don't have who's following that culture. Because it's just changed. So it's the same place, the same people. Because just the modes have changed, and so it just adjusts. You know what I'm saying? So that's the difficulty. So they establish their morality and ethics, for the purpose of whatever it is, the kind of sense gratification that they want. And then you have your rules. Then you're going to have justice also. It means we're going to have economics, because without economics, how do you get the facilities that everybody's working towards? Right? And where everybody works towards should produce profit. Right? So there must be that. That's why you see, when you use the pranamoic societies, they're generally always the bourgeois society. Because it's just about economics. If nothing else, if no other argument works, bring out economics, then everyone buys. Right? Like that. And so then you have to have that. Now that you have a facility, it means you have the work together, you have the facility, you can get that facility, you can enjoy that facility, now you need justice. To make sure no one takes advantage. You understand? So these are inherent parts of this. So you'll generally see whenever the influence of kind of the modern elements come in, you'll always see that they'll talk about, so modern means it's not Vedic, right? You'll always see that the discussion will be about, about money, about justice, about ethics or morality. It won't go beyond that. It won't go by tradition, it won't by authority, unless it's their tradition. And their tradition, who knows how old it is, Then, in Manamoy, it means now it's based on the theistic aspect. It's God, it's God's laws. So, a lower end, it's God's laws, but he's not really controlling the thing. So you will call them theists, but it's kind of like they're still, it's in between Manamoy and Pranamoy. So, the social construct is Pranamoy, but there is the idea that God is there. And so, because the two don't actually have a problem with each other, right? Because you can be purely pranamoy and have a belief in God only in as much as that belief in God makes everyone follow the rules, right? Because if you believe in God, then ethics will go nicely, morality will go nicely, and the justice will go nicely. like that. But we'll draw the line at economics. If it gets in the way, then we're going to break that down to get more economics. But then, not understanding as they break that down, then you also break down the reason why they're willing to work together. Because if you put the emphasis on the economics too much, it brings out too much of the individual. Right? Means the modern. How do you sell something? Because the individual has to want it. Right? But it has to be in the context of the group. You know? In that it's something that you want so that you stand out in the group. But if they make it too much about the individual, then the economics will break down because then people don't care. They just do their own thing. You know? So you have to create this sense of working together, but it has to be that you're unique within this. So it's always a balance. You'll always see there's a pendulum swing in that. So it's the most volatile, you can say, of all the positions. Also the most popular. Right? And so then when you bring in the world religions and that, they'll touch on the theistic aspect and that there is some ultimate laws in morality and all that. And the more they have that, the more you see is they don't really take part in the pranamoy kind of cultural scene. They have their own cultural scene and they have their own tight communities and everything like that. But it's not necessarily that they're economically very strong. They may be, but it's just a matter of whether they have a culture or not. You know? Does that make sense? So you see is that, you know, like the, except like the Judaic, then they have a culture that goes back. You know, like that. The Islamic, they have a bit of a culture. The Christian, then, is constantly changing. So they don't really have, because modern Christianity is based on throwing out the religion. Right? Islam was about establishing it. Judaism was about establishing it. But Christianity is about throwing out the old and creating a new. So that means that formula, then they're constantly creating a new one. Right? So it's just the nature. So depending on what they do, there'll be more community, less community, like that.
No community.
yeah. And so then as you go up, then they accept the Veda. Right. So then they'll do that, but it'll be purely for karmakanda. Right. They just want their material benefits and everything like that. Then you'll see as they go a little bit higher, then they see is that doesn't always work. So then you start going for, you're following the laws, you know, of Manamoy, that position, right? Because the one is that's the top that makes the position work the best. If you're working in sense gratification, you'll get the best facility in sense gratification if you work together and there's a concept of a supreme. Then it will work the best. That's why it's the top. You were wondering how it goes together. Then in the theistic, then that means theistic here means you're accepting the Veda. You're accepting the laws of God. And so then in there, then it's the bottom. It's where you're starting from. And then you basically use it for pranamoy, or you use it for karma, or you can use it for jnana. Right? And the devotees, they use it for bhakti. Because they'll take the karma and jnana and connect it to Krishna. And because of the nature of the manamoy, it functions quite well in the pranamoyic society. It's not a problem. We may see it as a problem, but that means we're not understanding the science so well. Because the reason behind whatever anybody does has to be some kind of theory, some philosophy, something that it works. Because otherwise, if collectivism doesn't work as a theory, you know, as an eternal position, why then what's the point of going for it? And if individual, the consideration of the individual is an eternal principle, how does that work? You know, economics isn't eternal. How does it work? So all these things are coming from the Supreme. That's why the system works. It's just a matter of whether they want to acknowledge the Supreme or not. Right? But the devotee will use all this connected to please Krishna. Right? So there's nothing for themselves. That's Yukta Vairagya. And so then being situated on the platform of Vijnanamaya, then they are practicing Anandamaya. And as they advance, it gets more and more on that side. Does that make sense? So when one comes to bhava, that's definitely on the Anandamaya side. You know, and then you continue till you get to prema. Prema is then the position, that's the standard position. So does that make sense? So you see is that the manamoya is that's the juncture between the two systems.
Right.
So dharma, artha, kama, that's one system. Mm-hmm. And the other is then the dharma, moksha, bhakti. Right? So then one may ask about the jnanis, just the moksha aspect, because they're just using dharma and moksha. But we see is that it actually is basically kind of more atheistic. So they're coming from dharma, artha, kama, then moksha. So they're not coming directly from dharma to moksha. Well, the devotees just go from dharma to I'm not this body to, you know, service to Krishna. So that's the actual process. And how is that coming? By the descending. So we see is up to the impersonal liberation is still an ascending process. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So you have all these overlaps, but if you look at one, you can see how it works. You look at the other, you can see how it works. Mm-hmm. But they're working in the same field. You know, it's just like, let's say, in a kitchen. Someone cooks one preparation, someone cooks something completely different. It's just how you use the kitchen, but it's the same kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that... Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so then they're witnessed, and so that point here is that they're witnessing. He certainly does not see. Although seeing, he does not see what is to be seen. The seeing capacity of the seer is lost. So he certainly does not see, because he doesn't see transcendence. He only sees the external senses. Although seeing, means seeing with his eyes, he does not see what is to be seen. He can't see how the Lord is pervading everything and everything's based on the Lord. The seeing capacity of the seer is lost because it's covered by ignorance.
It's not lost.
Hmm?
It's not lost.
Oh, here. The seeing capacity of the seer is not lost. Right? So the capacity to see the Supreme is not lost. It's just covered. And so by association, then you can... Does that make sense?
The seer here is an Atma.
Here's the Atma. Yeah. But as we know, is that because that's not being the point being brought out here. That'll be somewhere else where it's because the Supreme is seeing, therefore the Jiva is seeing. But that's not the point here. So they're just bringing out is that he does not see because he's an illusion. So even though he sees, he doesn't see. But even though he doesn't see, the seeing capacity of the seer is not lost. The soul at any time can take up spiritual life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then that's the third inference. Fourth inference can be understood to be the difference between the sufferer because of attachment to the body and the shelter of prema experienced apart from the body. Because prema is taking shelter of the soul, not the body. Right? Unless you're a sahajiya, then it takes shelter of the body because the soul doesn't have any prema. So, right? So, yeah. Anucheta Prakashika from Jiva Toshini. In the previous Anucheta, with reference to the Srimad Bhagavatam, the example of the life air was used to show the changeless nature of the soul. The same example is further developed in the next verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Sage Pipalayana explains that the life air is always following the soul into the different species of life, which can be grouped into four categories based on the source of birth. The life air goes into the various bodies, but it remains unchanged, although it seems to have changed. It's the same life air, but even though the body is different, just like water, you pour it into different vessels, it's the same water, but it has different shapes. It seems to change, but it doesn't. The water is still the same. From this, Jiva Goswami extracts two more arguments which prove that the soul is, in fact, distinct from the body and from Brahman, or the Supersoul. Footnote 22. Both the Buddhists and the Mayavadis claim that cognition is acquired in the conditioned state and then abandoned in the unconditioned state. According to this Bhagavatam verse, however, whether bound or liberated, the soul is eternally changeless and has the quality of cognition as its essential nature. So that's the point also being made there, is that the seeing capacity of the seer is not lost. It means he is consciousness. Right, so cognition is the nature of the soul. Yes.
Why are they afraid of cognition, both the Buddhists and the Mayavadis?
Because they only know material. They don't understand spiritual. That's the whole point, is they don't really want there to be spiritual. It's just like, let's say... Read this article where there was this person. He travels regularly on flights, and The person who wrote the article, and that, you know, is about, I don't know what it was about, I only remember this part of the article. So they notice that the person next to them, when the stewardess comes down and, you know, is checking for seat belts, he has the seat belt there and is kind of holding, you know, and looking as if it's done. But the guy sitting there knows he hasn't clicked the seat belt. And he notices whenever they don't care, you know, when they put off the seat belt sign, he doesn't have it on. So at some point he asked him about it, because, you know, this was written at the stage where it was kind of like it was recommended to wear it, but they weren't saying you have to. And so then, and even then it was one of those, it's recommended, it was kind of like before, like you wear seatbelts on the car, it's recommended, but there's no law about it. So then he asked him about that, and he says, well, it says one time he was in a plane crash, and the plane crashed, and he didn't have a seatbelt on. And so, you know, because he was probably one of those guys that, you know, that kind of thing. And so, somehow or another, it crashing, the plane broke, and he went flying out of the plane. So, he didn't get killed, but everybody else who was wearing their seatbelt, they didn't leave the plane. The plane exploded, right? And they all died. So, he was the only, like, survivor, or whoever else fell out that front part. So, he will not fix it, you know, tighten, you know, click the seatbelt. He will not, you know, fasten it. Right? You know what I'm saying? Because you get this impression. Does that make sense? You know, or the example of the cow. It was in the barn, there was a fire in the barn, so it gets scared. Then anytime it sees red, it thinks fire. Right? So, the living entity, because everything is personal, everything is dealing, and there's the mind, the senses, the emotions, the relationships, and at some point they find that all of it creates pain. So then they identify that pain is coming because of, you know, form, relationships, you know, thinking, feeling, willing, the senses, you know, economic, whatever it is that people do in Dharma, Artha, and Kama, that all the problem comes from there. So their solution is just the opposite. You know, so it's like sometimes you go in and let's say something's gone wrong in the temple, so the management did it one way, so the next management, their idea, do it the opposite. You know, or in politics, they're doing something one way, you do it the opposite. No, you just, as if there's something wrong in what the person's done, find what's wrong, remove that. Whatever's good, leave that. But because they throw it all out, then, you know what I'm saying? So it's a common thing, you see. And so then the living entity gets afraid of personalism. So they can only accommodate impersonal. And so then they come up with their philosophies. You know, the Mayavadi is extreme and the Buddhism is more extreme. Like that. So it's just a matter of that. You know, it's just they have a samskar, and so they can't get beyond the material samskar. So they're not willing to take up the process that you can go beyond. They'll take up some of the religious aspects. They don't mind chanting or this or that. So if you can engage them, that's the advantage. You can engage them in chanting Hare Krishna, taking prasad. They'll get taught, purified, they'll move forward. But you have to get rid of that impression. Does that make sense? You know, like people don't have necessarily an impression of religious things, so that you don't mind taking up the process. Or they've had a good experience of religion, but it just wasn't enough. So then coming in contact with Krishna consciousness, they can take it up. But if someone has a bad experience of religion, or authority or that, you'll see that they have troubles taking it up. Or even they take it up, there'll be a nartus in these areas of rules and regulations, authority, these kind of things. You know, other people, you know. So it's just the conditioning. Yes?
Can you explain more about how to remove this anatta of authority?
Of?
Authority issue.
Authority issue. The point is logically, does it work that if there's an authority, then things go more smoothly? Right? Because then you have, let's say you want to learn something. Right? So now, if you go to someone who already knows that and accept them as authority, your learning process goes quicker. But if they say, do like this, and you say, no, I'm going to do like that, it won't go very well. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the principle of authority then has to be accepted. Right? And so if there is that principle of authority that and it works, that means it comes from Krishna, you know, by the formula of cause and effect. So then, he being the cause, then there's the effect, so therefore within each thing you'll have that aspect. Right? So now, then, if there's authority within the material, and it's a reflection, then there must be the concept of spiritual authority. Right? So then that spiritual authority, because you're taking it that they know spirit. And so then you can take them as an authority of how that works. So if you want to move forward spiritual life, then they know how to do it. Now, very important in this is to understand that yukta vairagya means you don't see the material world as different than Krishna's energies. Right? So for someone who understands yukta vairagya, they won't have any problem accepting the spiritual authorities on the spiritual platform and how to engage the material platform in Krishna's service. They'll be an authority because that's what you're engaging. Spiritual life, spiritual endeavor means you're engaging here in the material world those things that we generally would call material in Krishna's service. Does that make sense? Someone who doesn't understand this philosophical point, then they'll think there's a difference between the matter and spirit and that they're not connected to Krishna. So they deify Krishna. And therefore, then, when the acharyas come here, then they can't, they can say, yes, they know the spiritual, but they don't know the material, so they can't apply that in the material. We have to do that. So, due to attachment to their own conditioning, they won't give the proper credit where credit's due. And they give unnecessary credit where it's not due at all. You know, to their own perspective. Right? So, yes, you're supposed to, it's supposed to be one of the things. Like in Manu it says, you first start with the authority of the Veda. Then, from the Veda, then the Smriti says, the tradition. And then from the tradition, then how it's being practiced by the, you know, advanced personalities. Then, it's your own, how you find that all relates and fits to you. So the individual's consideration is there, but it has to have the other three as a basis. Otherwise, then we could come up with anything. If you want to go back to Godhead, you have to start there, then bring it down to here. But if you start with yourself as the individual and then try to do, it's an ascending process. So you'll only accept those things from tradition and the Veda and the, you know, what others are doing, authority, what you like. You understand? So it's a very standard mistake. So we have to understand the descending process means they know because you're engaging the lower in the service of the higher. Right? Because if you say, no, but we know the material world, okay, you know the material world in connection of what? Of karma. You don't know it in connection of bhakti. Bhakti is independent. So you can't say, my knowledge of karma is what makes bhakti work. That's against the philosophy. Does that make sense? So it's a very simple point. It's just lack of understanding the philosophy and culture. So it has some philosophy without the religion. Because the religion is then where you're seeing the difference. Right? We're taking it that the Vedic religion then is only for, you know, for India. And anywhere else it doesn't apply. Right? But the problem comes up is that the Vedic is universal. You can not follow it and come up with derivations of it or perversions or distortions. But you're still starting with that. Does that make sense? So it's descending. Then you find how it does fit into your situation. And know the situation as not so ideal. It's a distortion, so it's not so great. But that's where we're at, so that's where we start. Just like you're trying to get to Calcutta, and so you're analyzing where you are, and you find that when you go up the road, you know, you're going up the road from here, and it goes straight basically all the way, and then at one point on the left you see the old Ganga path, right? And then it turns right through Sondanga, and it goes like that all the way out to the main road. Yeah? So on that left there, you find that you're sitting in somebody's rice field out there. So now the whole point is that you're going from the descending. So I'm trying to get, you know, to Calcutta. So therefore, you know, you have to be on that particular road. The rice fields is not the, you know. You know, the rule is not all roads lead to the rice field here, you know. So you have to get on that, you have to be on that road. You're sitting in the mud in the rice field. Not ideal. So you have to be able to understand that's where you are, so you stand up, and then you walk towards the road, and then being on the road, then you follow that to Calcutta. Does that make sense? So that, and you understand that sitting in the rice field, that's not actually that great, but that's where you are. So you are going to be walking through the rice field for some time. But you're walking through the rice field to get out of the rice field. You understand? So when we use this ascending process, and we go, I'm in the rice field. And this is who I am. And so then it's a matter of, well, if we can bring the road over to where I am, then that's all right. Otherwise, my position here is just as good as the road. So then it's lacking intelligence because you can't tell the difference between things. Or you're making things similar that aren't. So it's a mode of ignorance. You're reversing. Or let's say, ajnana shakti. Does that make sense? So you have to see that you're following properly. So you can see in theory it works. Then it's just a matter of applying it and trying to find, you know, some position that you can work in under authority, those authorities you can work with, and then move forward. But you always have to keep the philosophy in mind that it is correct. You may have bad experiences, but, you know, that's the way it goes. You know?
So, like, just recently, like, I just met a person who said to me about the proper thing to do is just chant 64 rounds, and this service is more like distraction. This is the main focus. You should like that. That's the rounds. So what's in you, like, is it like some authority issues, or is it like a person who's...
And it's independence. You see, as the independent issue, because all the other elements means you have to work with others. And so they just don't, they like just being on their own. And so, okay. But the whole point is that yukta vairagya means you're engaging the senses and the lord of the senses, service. So that would include, you know, but he's saying 64 rounds. No, that's not the rule. Saying that it's 64 rounds, then he's taking up an element of a religious rule. The actual rule is chanting Hare Krishna 24 hours a day. That's the rule. Right? So if you're taking that and they're trying to as much as they can absorb themselves, then that's okay if they're able to do it. And if not, then they also see is that it's in pursuance of chanting or other things like that, so then it's part of it, like you have a job that gets you money, so that pays the bills, so then you can spend time chanting. Right? So, you know, directly or indirectly, then you're seeing it connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? Then the other aspect comes up is that if we're taking it as 64 rounds, how long does that take you to chant 64 rounds? And so then what are you doing other than that? Because if it's all it is just chanting 64 rounds, then that means one's doing no other process, no other religious process. One doesn't eat, one doesn't take a bath, one doesn't sleep, one doesn't interact with others. So if that's the case, then great. But then that means go out into the forest. Why you'll be sitting here in Mayapur, you know, and trying to get whatever facilities you need, but you should be out in the forest. Then you can just chant, and who cares? You know what I'm saying? So what's the religious process you'll apply to there? And then where do you get the authority for those religious processes from? Are they coming from the Veda? Are they coming from the Acharyas? Right? If they're just making them up and just following their own previous, you know, lifestyle, you know, in a purified way, you remove the four, you know, the problem of the four, you know, you follow the four regular principles. You follow your conditioned lifestyle following the four regular principles. And then you add on to that chanting 64. It's nice, you'll advance nicely and all that, but one shouldn't be propagating that. Right? Does that make sense? Because the point is that if that's the only way, that may work for that person, but can every person sit down and chant 64? Prabhupada started with that. didn't. So then 32, then 16, and then engaging everybody in all kinds of activities. Right? They couldn't chant Jap all day, but they could do kirtan for, you know, 8, 12 hours a day. Does that make sense? So he finds what works. You can't do Jap, then you do discussions on the scriptures. You know, you worship the deities, services in connection with that. So that way, then, one is engaged in 64 rounds worth of service. 16 is done as rounds and 48 is service. Like that. But the idea is that you're supposed to be chanting 24/7, not 64. 64 is like the minimum. It's a solid minimum. Does that make sense? Yeah. But it's not that that's it. Does that make sense? The third argument is based on the witness and the witnessed. During deep sleep, when the identification with the mind and senses is slackened, the soul witnesses his own self. This experience he recollects on awakening. This proves the changeless nature of the soul, distinct from the body and the senses. The fourth argument is based on the fact that it is the jiva who experiences the material troubles and tribulations and not the supersoul. Although both are in the same body, in the next Anucheta, Srila Jiva Goswami summarizes these points. Srila Baladeva Dibhushana. In the example, the prana does not change since it remains in one form in various bodies. When in deep sleep with the senses and ahankara, ahami, merge, sane, in the Atma remains unchanged, kutastha. Absence of upadis means that they have been dissolved. However, liberation does not take place in deep sleep because of the existence of very subtle impressions. When the material ahankar dissolves, the sense of I related to the surupa, the jiva, remains. Because of this, the jiva thinks, I slept happily. But footnote 23. The three basic psychological states of the jiva are as follows. Jagran, external wakefulness, which is sattvic, and then body, mind, and false ego are active. 2. Supti, or swapna, dreaming, rajasic, body's inactive, mind and false ego are active. And shushupti, dreamless deep sleep. Tamasic, body, mind and false ego are inactive. In jagra, consciousness flowing along the subtle channel of the mind through the senses to the sense objects. In swapna, the mind is active and engaged, not with the sense objects, but with the memory of them. In Sushupti, the three components of the subtle body are dormant. Sahota Swami, in his book Vedanta Psychology, explains how Vaishnavas and Mayavadis disagree on the conclusions to be drawn from this analysis. Right? So, basically, it's kind of similar up to that point, but it's in Sushupti. Then we'll say the soul still exists and is conscious. He's conscious of his own existence. Right? And they'll say, is that, no, there's nothingness. So it's like the Buddhists. Yeah. Up to liberation, basically what we say and they say will be the same. But at the point of liberation and beyond, that's where now we differ. Srila Prabhupada elaborates on this in his Bhagavad Gita lecture in London, August 1973.
Footnote continues.
Footnote continues. Oh, it does. Wow. Okay. Oh, this is. So I thought it was just saying before this came from him. Okay. I didn't see the two dots. Okay. About Sushupti, the tamasic state, Shankaracharya argues that the self becomes the witness of primeval avidya. By this act of witnessing avidya, the ahankara dissolves. For Shankara, Sushupti is the threshold of pure consciousness. In that, the self is freed from material perceptions and conceptions. Right? So you see they're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
In one sense, it's going up because then they're out of the particular identities that are there within the material, within the, you know, the mahatattva that it affords. But they're not away from avidya. Right? So it's that the Mahatattva has the point is it's the opportunity in which the living entities can now express their desire to control and enjoy. So that's why the polluted consciousness is there before the three forms of it, in the way of goodness, passion, ignorance, the false ego, and what is it? Tamasa, Tejasa, and Vaikarika, right? So in those three, so Lord Shiva, he is that combination of all those kinds of ignorance. And so then he can deal with the transcendental aspect, right, because of the Vasudeva, but he also can deal with the other three, because of the Shankarsha, Prajumna, Adiruddha, that they're dealing with the material. Does that make sense? No?
I just lost it.
No. Yeah? Yes, it's coming up. I think Lord Chaitanya explaining this to Sanatana Goswami. It's coming up. So, in here then, what we're pointing out is that this the ego and all that, there's the aspect that's before the ability to manifest it, but there's still the aspect after. So they're only getting rid of the ones after, means in Brahma's creation, but they're not getting rid of the one that's before in the primary creation. They're not getting rid of the avidya that they're under. They think because we see it, we're away from it. No. You know, it's just like you're in a car, you see the car, it doesn't mean you're out of the car. So that's the whole problem, is that they're then in that place. So they may come to that Vasudeva Sattva, but this Vasudeva Sattva is within the Mahatattva. It's not what's beyond the Mahatattva. So they're this side of the Viraja. They can't get the impersonalist, the Buddhist, that even if they can liberate themselves, they can't get beyond the Viraja. So what's the original form of this? That's the Brahma Bhuta platform. That's why they only get liberated. They don't come to Brahma Bhuta. They may talk that they're Brahma Bhuta, but they don't actually. Does that make any more sense?
Yeah, somebody asked me a question recently. But if we talk about Karan Sharira, which is the subtlest body.
Right.
So when the jivas go back into body of Vishnu, what happened to the, where's that body?
That's there with them.
Also it goes in there.
Yeah, otherwise where is it going to go? Because they're still in avidya. Right, because you have the avidya potency. And then a manifestation of that avidya potency is going to be through the Tejasa, Tamasa, and Vaikarika. Mm-hmm. Egos.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and that'll be based on that platform of Vasudeva. Because Vasudeva is the basis of all this. And so then, within this, then they can act. So that's the whole point, is the conditioning of the soul has already happened before they've left the spiritual world.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just like, let us say someone's in a room with a bunch of friends that he's been, you know, they're doing something, whatever they're doing. And this person has been part of that and's decided, no, I'm not going to be part of this anymore. So he's leaving. But he's already in the consciousness of the outside of that group before he's left the group. While he's still in the room, he's in the outside consciousness. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is that avidya shakti is beyond the manifestation of it. But in the spiritual world, you don't see any manifestation of it. That's why it says you see the other side of the viraja. Then that's where then you come under the influence of the avidya shakti. So you're no longer actually functioning in the spiritual world, you're functioning in the material world. Though the place is the spiritual world. Like we're here in Mayapur. It's the spiritual world. We can act in a mundane way. Or we could act in a spiritual way. But if you go beyond the Viraja, then that opportunity is not there. In Goloka, it's only going to be spiritual. In Vaikuntha, it's only going to be spiritual. No one's going to do that. But the point is the Tathasta Shakti holds both of them together. Therefore, in the Boma Lila, it has both there. So Krishna and his associates are on the spiritual platform, the demons on the material platform. But they're in the same place at the same time, like the soul is in the body. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that overlap there. So that's why it's so hard to understand. That's why it's not a point to discuss. It's either by purification association, it makes sense. You can see the two achinta beta beta tattva combined there, or you can't. And if you can't, what's the point of arguing it? You know, it's just like people that can't see at all, what's the point of them discussing color? But if you can see color, then you discuss it. But the point is, if you see it, then there's no need to discuss it. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, it's understood. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.